And now to the second part of our interview with author David Friedman. On last week's show, he discussed his recent book Wrong, Why the Experts Keep Failing Us, and talked about the field of medical research, which he believes is littered with expert opinion that's just plain wrong. Well, this week he continues his expose on supposed experts and takes aim at the lucrative area of management consultants and their claims to expertise. Here's David Friedman, starting with the idea that the practices of successful companies can be identified and copied.
This is sort of the essence of what happens among consultants, and it's true, in fact, of most business literature. It's based around the case study. The idea is you go out and you look at what companies are successful, and then ask yourself, well, what do these successful companies have in common that I can then borrow and adopt myself so I can be successful like them? That turns out to be a massively flawed enterprise. It turns out there are many, many reasons why that's true. For one thing, companies that are successful today are often unsuccessful tomorrow. Now, when I wrote this book, I focused in on Toyota as an example. This was before all the bad news about Toyota came to light over the past few years. So that happened after my book was written.
To your credit, you do express a certain skepticism about its reputation, or you did at that time.
I did. Yes, that's right. I said in the book, you know, I pointed out why people should be very, very careful about assuming that they should be imitating Toyota. And Toyota was the company to imitate, at least for a large segment of the business world, for at least a decade, because of their successes. And you can go back in time and look at almost any company that was held up as the role model. And it turns out that at the very peak of when that company was being held up as the role model, was pretty much when the company was very likely about to self-destruct or at least run into serious problems. Yeah. And you could see just in the car industry, let's remember, General Motors was once the absolute epitome of everything that an organization should be, and on. Enron was held up as the total role model of where companies were evolving in the 21st century, right before it turned out to be the most poorly run, inept, and dishonest company on the face of the earth. So today's success is tomorrow's failure. And even if these companies did stay successful, when we try to ask ourselves, well, what is it about this company that made it successful, it's almost never what the consultants and the experts pull out. Often it's just plain dumb luck or even excessive risk, which is a terrible thing to try to imitate. You'd think it would be easy for companies. It's all about money, right? But it's really not nearly that simple. There are all kinds of ways of juggling the books and having a company look like a success on paper when, in fact, really what's happening behind the scenes is a total disaster. You would have said BP, in fact, many people did, say that BP was an incredible success within the oil industry until we suddenly found out that they've been highly, highly risky with the way they have been choosing and running a lot of their drilling sites. And now, of course, they've paid the price for it, as have we all.
Do you think that business analysts underestimate the importance of luck in business success? I think you say at some point in your book that often being in the right place at the right time historically contributes an awful amount to success.
It's just undeniable. I mean, let's look at the situation. I mean, suppose companies were all making their decisions randomly, that they had absolutely no good input into what it is they should be doing in order to make more money. Well, if that were the case, the law of odds tells you that out of the thousands and thousands of major organizations out there, there's going to be some subset of them that by sheer luck will end up making a bunch of what turns out to be good decisions in retrospect that will catapult them into tremendous financial success. If we then look at those companies and say, wow, well, what did these guys do because I want to do that, the correct answer is they got lucky. They had a bunch of lucky guesses. Maybe you will tomorrow, maybe you won't, and they probably won't continue their lucky streak. And so there's really nothing to learn from those companies. And as I say, it's often worse than that. It's often some of the worst, riskiest decisions that pay off. Usually they won't, but maybe it's one out of 10 companies that make very risky decisions will kind of hit the lottery, get very successful for it, and then we'll end up imitating them when, in fact, they're really making terrible decisions.
One of the indicators of good research in any field is that you can replicate the results. Is there much replication done in the field of business studies?
Almost none. Actually, this is a question that people have actually studied. They go out and study who's studying what. These are so-called meta-researchers. And yeah, people have gone out and studied whether business research is really validated through other findings. In other words, whether people sort of cross-study things or simply repeat studies. And the answer is almost never. Researchers much prefer, just like medical researchers, business researchers do much better to find their own interesting breakthrough unique findings, and everyone else goes off and do their own thing, and so therefore nobody's ever checking on anyone else, and everything sort of remains uncontested out there.
That's why the ideas and the books keep changing in this field so quickly.
Exactly. I mean, you're not going to have a business bestseller by simply recapitulating what's already been told, or by cross-checking someone else's findings and backing it up. You're going to do it by striking out in a new direction, essentially saying, well, everybody had it wrong, or things have changed, and here's what the new company has to do in the coming decade to succeed. Those are the books that sell well, and therefore, those are the books that people try to write.
David, what about the so-called Hawthorne effect, this notion that even if management consultants are on the wrong track, the simple process of looking and paying attention to an organization will lift its performance for a short period?
Yeah, that's been something that researchers have known for a while, which is this idea that if you stand over someone's shoulder, they're likelier to do a better job. So researchers come in and go, well, what happens if we change this in an organization? And lo and behold, they find out that things improve. Well, what do you know? Things did improve because all of a sudden all the workers or managers suddenly knew they were being closely watched. And they find ways to get the results that everybody's hoping to get. It's another form of bias. As an interesting footnote, it's called the Hawthorne effect because of a study carried out at the General Electric Hawthorne plants. That study itself turned out to be highly flawed. In effect, the Hawthorne effect succumbed to the Hawthorne effect itself, and is now believed to not be a good study.
One last question, David, and it's a bit unfair because you don't cover it in the book. The book's not about this, but if we can't trust so many experts, have you thought about what the implications might be for government, which has to rely on some advice in areas such as education and healthcare to do things? What does this mean?
Yes, well, I think what it means is probably what most of us have observed about government. Government gets it wrong a lot of the time, and in fact, everybody does. It's sort of the way of the world, and it's true of government, too. I think when we most have to duck from government is when they act as if they know what's going on. I think government has to and should consult experts. Experts should be part of the decision-making process. I don't think we ever want to ignore what experts have to say. I think we need to take it into consideration. I think scientists and learned people who gather and analyze data are our best bet at figuring out what's going on. It just so happens that even they get it wrong most of the time. So government does too. But of course, government decision makers, they don't have to do what the experts tell them to do. They can use their own common sense. They can sift through all their experience, listen to a bunch of people, listen to the public. And when you take everything into account, I think you're likely to make a better decision than when you only listen to the experts. And that's why I think some leaders do better in government than others do.
David Friedman, thanks very much for joining us today and setting us right about so much that is wrong.
Oh, thank you.
David Friedman, his book Wrong, Why the Experts Keep Failing Us, is published by Little Brown.
Next week on Counterpoint, where the good things just keep on coming, Robert Bryce takes us through his new book, Power Hungry, The Myths of Green Energy and the Real Fuel of the Future. He's no fan of big oil, but he is passionately committed to keeping ideology out of physics and chemistry. For Robert Bryce, facts is facts. In one section of the book, he takes on the widely held belief that Denmark provides an alternative energy model that countries like Australia or the USA should look seriously at adopting. Here's a quick preview.
This is one of the great fallacies that, oh, if only we were more like Denmark, because they're running their entire economy on wind energy and butterfly farts. But the reality is that they are, in fact, more oil dependent than the U.S. So this is the main point. I mean, you know, I talk about Denmark and examine their record very closely, but when you look at the world energy system, it consumes about 226 million barrels of oil equivalent per day. That's from everything, hydro, wind, solar, nuclear, coal, gas, etc. Of that 226 million barrels of oil equivalent, 200 million barrels per day come from coal, oil, and natural gas. That's 23.5 Saudi Arabia's. So if we're going to talk about getting off of hydrocarbons, then let's start with the numbers and discuss the scale. And that is the key issue. It is one of the four imperatives, but is the issue that continually gets lost in the noise because people say, oh, well, we'll just switch to solar and wind. Okay, that's fine. Just as soon as you find the equivalent of 23 Saudi Arabias of carbon-free energy, call me.
Robert Bryce. He's on next week's show discussing his new book, Power Hungry, The Myths of Green Energy and the Real Fuels of the Future. And that's just about it from us today.
Our producer is Ian Coombe. Our sound engineer is John Diamond. I'm Michael Duffy.
And I'm Paul Comrie Thompson. Until next time, see you around like a rhododendron. Goodbye.
Rhododendrons aren't round.